Welcome back to PGR Matters. In this episode, we explore open access publishing. Although possibly the oldest and most recognisable form of open research practice, as we've heard from Grant Young in episode 1, there's also great complexity facing researchers at this moment in time. The landscape of open access publishing is not straightforward due to the different academic publishing models that are currently in operation. From the researcher and institutional perspectives, however, there are a finite number of routes to publishing: green, gold, and diamond, sometimes also called platinum. Green normally involves making a work available through a public repository, such as a university's own repository. This document may not have been through the peer review process, copy edited, or typeset in the style of the finished publication. This might involve an author-accepted manuscript, for example, that's made available after an embargo period, such as 6 to 24 months after the release of the work by the publisher. The green route tends to be the minimum requirement for academic staff in higher education institutions in the UK. Gold is much simpler. The publisher makes the work available as open access, normally through the payment of an article processing charge, or APC, or book processing charge, BPC. The funds for these charges need to come from somewhere, and it's often a funder or institution that covers them. Diamond access involves a significant departure from the two routes just mentioned in that it relies on a publishing model that does not require the author to provide funds for open access. Instead, a collective agreement between institutions or an in-house publisher, such as a university press, will either cover charges or host the publication. All this means that the researcher will need to do some work to determine the best publication route. They'll also need to think about what form of open access they're providing. As we mentioned in our last episode, some research outputs might be in a form that can be adapted or manipulated in some way to create new datasets or artifacts. This is where open access licensing comes in. The most prominent form of license available is called Creative Commons. There are currently 6 forms of CC license, and these range from the most permissive CC BY to the more restrictive CC BY NC ND. The letters BY simply indicate by, so namely the attribution to the creator of the work. NC stands for non-commercial, and ND stands for no derivative works. For example, although verbatim copies of the work can be shared with others, it cannot be altered or remixed. Another form of the license includes the letters SA, which indicate share-alike. This means that any derivative work needs to be licensed under the same terms, thereby maintaining the same level of permission. To understand more about open access publishing and its implications for books, which remain popular as a research output in the arts, humanities, and some areas of the social sciences, I spoke to Sean Anderson, Open Access Fund Coordinator at the University of Essex.
You've been very heavily involved in this because I really wouldn't be able to identify a lot of our contributors and to be working with your colleagues at Essex if it hadn't been for the brilliant promotional work that you've done around the Open Access Fund at Essex and the outputs that have been created. There's blog posts, there are videos on there, there's all sorts of great stuff on the website. So my first question, I suppose, is why is the promotion of open access publishing been so important for the University of Essex and also, I guess, for you by extension of that? Yeah,
sure. Well, thank you for your very kind words, Matthew. It's an absolute pleasure to be here and have the opportunity to talk about it. It's quite a mission amongst our team, open research and open access. And the university has a pretty strong open research position statement. And it is dedicated to enabling and sharing replication of our research. And it boils down to a phrase you probably heard quite often, to be as open as possible and as closed as necessary. Mm. And the team here that I joined a few years back really laid that groundwork and are passionately committed. I know you'll be talking to them later. And I'm very fortunate to join that and to be able to add my own enthusiasm for open access, because I've seen the benefits from other angles, and it's great to be a part of it. And it is really key, and of course it's key to any university to a degree because of the ref submissions. Mm. They're so important.
I asked Sean what the routes into open access look like at the University of Essex.
I mean, we have the Essex repository, of course, and self-archiving, which we encourage. We had a blog post just go live today on LinkedIn about that, just to reiterate the basic steps that all our academics and PGR students can take to benefit from that, to get their work out there. Read and publish agreements we still have, of course. They're still very popular, get a lot of use. It makes a really big difference, especially in certain subject areas. Mm-hmm. Our computer studies and science, yeah, make use of them extensively.
Could I just ask you a bit more about read and publish, because it's something we've covered a little bit in the first episode of this three-parter for the podcast. But do you want to explain a little bit more how that works and what that sort of means to academics and to institutions?
Yeah, of course. It's where we have an agreement with a publisher, by which our academics are able to publish their work open access without direct charge to them. And readers also have access to those journals if, for example, there are a hybrid journal, which is a mix of open and subscription. And these read and publish agreements with publishers can open up hundreds of journals, and our academics can publish their work through the normal processes, you know, as the standards are as high as anywhere else. There's no difference there. But open access without having to face a fee. There is a fee to be paid by the university, of course. It's a year or a 2-year contract direct with the publisher, and there are costs, of course. But it does facilitate and open up lots of journals. And I think not long after I joined, I totted up journals, which was ambitious, but once I started, I had to keep going. And it was well over 2,500, I think, we had at the time.
Wow. Wonderful. Fantastic. So a lot of work going on there. What are there any other kinds of approaches that you've taken?
Well, we have, as everywhere else, we work as a support for the UKRI open access. So where an author has that funding, we facilitate that, because it has to come through us rather than the author, especially for long form. Mm. So we do that. We promote and support as much diamond publishing as we can. So journals that are set up to be open to read and open to publish as well. We have our rights retention policy, of course, which we encourage authors to use, which essentially puts their copyright onto the author's accepted manuscript, so before it goes to print. And that's the version that we then upload to the repository, and then which operates really is the open access version of an article, even if that finished version of record is published behind a paywall. The AAM can be shared and used just as any open access article.
Through our conversation, Sean compared his open access work to his background in more traditional publishing.
Yeah, it was about 23 years altogether. And it was a period of great change. When I began, ebooks were something on the horizon, but which never actually appeared, because there wasn't an infrastructure really. Aggregators just didn't exist. The publishing industry was waiting for aggregators to exist. And then when they came along, everything changed, and print edition sales plummeted, and licenses got very expensive. Print edition costs, which were already high when I joined, you know, a book was £40, which I thought was staggering. And by the time I left, an academic volume at 140 was perfectly standard. Incredible costs, really. And open access came very late to the publisher that I was primarily working for. And when it did come, it very wisely went to the academic studies, African studies strand that we had. A really excellent series, often written by African academics as well. So it was super worthwhile, and we were very proud of it. And it was incredibly difficult to ever get these books back into Africa, to the communities that they discussed and to the academics that were working on them. It was really difficult for a number of reasons, but financial primarily. Really difficult. Even when we tried locally licensed paperback editions, they still were very expensive for students and academics, because there's only so many books an academic can actually buy, and there's only so many a library can actually buy, even at a good price. And open access was just perfect. It was really inspiring. That barrier immediately disappeared. And upon publication, there it was, a link, DOI. And there you go. The author has it, can share it with everyone. The university has it. Students have it. Journals have it. Everywhere has it. It was fabulous. It was really inspiring. After 20, however many years of trying to sell super expensive books, it was really game changing for me. It was wonderful to do it. And the response you get was terrific. Because a number of times you get a very positive response to a publication announcement, followed by, I don't have £80 or £100 and £120. And that just went. And suddenly you could share really useful books with NGOs and charities and things who are often very interested in a lot of these, especially in something like African studies. And they have no funds for books, very limited. And it was brilliant for that.
Accessibility is really vital. So actually, you know, DOI that you've mentioned there is important. The digital object identifier is really vital to that, so that there is this single stable reference point that text material can be accessed from. The other aspect of that, though, I suppose that's not quite the whole story, is around discoverability of scholars' research. And this is something that's really intrigued me and has impressed me a lot with the work you've been doing at Essex, is actually how you're contributing to making this open access material more discoverable. Do you want to say maybe a little bit about your approach to that at the university at the moment?
Yeah, sure. Happy to. I think from it's essentially the problem that you have in any promotion or marketing. So it's the same problem I had in publishing, really. You've got one book, when a journal might have 200 books a month, and you've got to get something to their attention. So I think it's something I thoroughly enjoy working on here. There's kind of a mission vibe to it here at Essex, which is terrific. And it is a huge problem, because there's massive amounts of information out there. You know, everything's changed so much. And making things discoverable is a job. So we do as much as we can. And I'd like to think I maybe brought some of the things that I used to do here. So, I mean, I can rattle through a few of them. And OA generally provides many more opportunities than traditional publishing, which relies really on marketing and discounts and money off offers and things like that, which is always a barrier. 20% discount off £130 book is a benefit to certain people, but not to that many. And we clear all those barriers with OA. I have always thought that primarily authors are best placed to share their work. Even for a book that you have to sell, they're at the heart of their community and they speak with authority. And I was always, as a marketing person, an outsider in that community. And the responses were very different, and I would always encourage authors to share their own work and to share news of it, to share it's coming, to share that they're at a conference. Everything like that is very effective. And we provide our authors, we have a little simple one-page guide, lots of tips of best places to share, how to share, where to embed your DOI, things like this. Just a little guide. We always ask for their feedback because they probably have lots of ideas too. But when it comes to spreading the word, we do play a role in that, and it's something I really enjoy. We have our LinkedIn page. The library's LinkedIn page is a real focus. And we share news of publication announcements. So we always have a little plug, and we tag in as many people as we can. Tag their publisher, for example. That's always really important. Keep it relevant. You always got to keep it relevant. But if they're related to it, you can tag them in. That spreads the word. You see your posts spread widely, which is very satisfying. But we also share a lot of news on there as well. We try to make it a go-to. So for events, for webinars, development, say for the UKRI long form, when that came in last year, we posted a lot of information about that so that people knew about it, for example. So it's not just announcements all the time, but it's always working to raise awareness and to share specific details.
Fantastic. The range of communication there and promotion, and also really focusing on that authority of the author, I suppose, that you were talking about there, having them involved, whether they're, you know, on camera talking about their work and their experience, or whether that's through you know, text on a blog post or through the social media channels that you've been circulating. I love what you were saying there about it being more about the communication, the announcement or the sharing, and less about the pushing and the selling, I suppose, which is quite a step change, I think, from the price tags and paywalls that have sat behind a lot of academic work for a very long time. Obviously, the reason we're recording this for the PGR Matters series is that we tend to be focusing on postgraduate researchers and some early career researchers. And maybe to finish off our conversation today, do you have any suggestions on how best to promote open access work? So how a research student, for instance, or a very early career researcher coming quite soon after their research degree might get into this?
Yes, I mean, do what you can locally. So get your work onto the repository at your institution and related subject repositories as well. Absolutely, do as much as you can like that. Join communities, groups, academic societies, professional societies, you know, if you can. Maintain your online research profiles, certainly. We really encourage that. Have them ready for when your prodigious output of article starts flowing. And use social media, which I know isn't first choice for a lot of people, and a lot of people don't use it personally. And you don't have to, but if you are willing to create, I think especially a LinkedIn, ResearchGate, Blue Sky, I think is pretty good. It's really worth it. It's such an easy way to plug into communities. I would say don't be shy about sharing links to your work and to things that you have done. People are interested. They will want to hear. And you are only sharing information. People can log it, or they can bookmark it, or they can get to it later. Generally, most people aren't going to mind. Don't be shy about sharing links, tagging a publisher, for example, if you ever do something like that. Tag relevant academic groups, societies, your own department. Your name will start to appear and be linked to work. It will be recognized. Always use the DOI when you do share. If you have a DOI, that's absolutely crucial. It helps your metrics, and it is, like you mentioned earlier, the one rock solid place where your work will always be. So that's really important. Embed that DOI wherever you can, into email signatures and the like, all sorts of places. Add your work to any reading lists that you may curate. That's important. If it's very relevant, there's absolutely no problem with doing that. Alert subject librarian. I recommend people contact their alumni groups, even just to share with people like that. Any media contacts you have, not many people do, but you can. They can develop over time, and they're really worth following up and maintaining if you can. If there's a newsworthy aspect to your work, you can always ask your university's media center to help you. And that was one thing I would always be told by journalists. Review editors were not always so encouraging because they have so much, but journalists are always desperate for material. And if it's relevant and it's well presented, there's a really good chance they can follow up on it. And that can be excellent exposure, and it can do people a world of good.
Among those people who've benefited from the Open Access Fund at the University of Essex are Dr. Alison Barker and Dr. Sean Seeger. Alison, who works within the institution's library, completed a PhD and sought to publish her research as a book.
From your PhD, you've been able to literally codify what you've been studying into a book. And I wonder if you'd like to tell us more about the publication, what it's really focusing on, and maybe what inspired you to go for a book form, because with a PhD you can produce lots of different outputs from your research, like journal articles, conference papers, etc. but what was it that really mattered around this?
I think for me the structure was the most important thing, because I had written the thesis around St. George, how he is depicted in art, and I wanted to focus on three different countries, partly because of my language skills in those areas, and partly because I had seen him in these different countries, and it just fascinated me as to why he was there. So I picked England, Italy and Germany, well, at least the Italian peninsula and the German-speaking lands, because, of course, there wasn't an Italy and there wasn't a Germany. And so I wanted to look particularly at why he appeared so similar in the way he looked. And I went with six iconographic commonalities of literally, if you look at an image, you think, that's St. George. I know that's St. George because he's got his dragon, and he's got his arm man, he's got his lance, and he's got his flag with the red cross on. And those are the things that I wanted to, for my own interest, really, I wanted to see if I was right in saying that he looks the same in all these places. Mm-hmm. And I did, and I found out that he does look basically the same in these different countries and areas, but means very different things to those different audiences. So I picked three different regions, but I had four case studies in my book. And the reason I had four rather than three was because I wanted to not just have, and this comes back to the structure that I was talking about at the beginning. I wanted to be able to explore the comparisons between the areas, the regions, and not just do a chapter on England, a chapter on Italian places, and a chapter on German-speaking places. So I mixed it up and did some comparisons. So, for example, going back to Venice, Venice was my case study, and contrasted it with Norwich.
Oh,
because in our wonderful, wonderful county of Norfolk, there are many towns and cities that have St. George as their patron saint. And the Guild of St. George in Norwich compared really interestingly with the Scuola that I was mentioning earlier in Venice, and their patron saint being St. George. And so I looked at the two organisations or corporate groups, really, and looked at George as a common identifying factor that unified the different people within those groups. And yeah, it's I have to say it's fascinating, and I really think, because the thesis was huge, 500 images, with the book I had to narrow down to 70 images only, and we can come on to images, but writing the book, I had to really think even more concisely about how St. George appears the same but means different things to different people. So one of my case studies is my groups, my guilds, and a corporate group. And my other three case studies were how St. George was used by and received by artists, by rulers, princes, and finally by us lot, the common person going on pilgrimage. And so, yeah, that's really how I structured the book and why the structure was so important.
Why did you choose to go for an open access publication rather than perhaps the more, you know, traditional publishing routes, which would be there would be a price tag basically to get access to the, you know, a hardbound or paperbound copy of the book or a digital version of the book?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And actually, before I published it, I was on the other end of open access. I was on the other end of trying to find my research, trying to read articles, trying to find information. And it wasn't always straightforward. And I think because I, as a student, I was always looking for articles, and I'm failed finding some there was a price tag on, as you've said, and I always avoided paying for it because I felt it was unjust, actually. That was one thing, but I also felt, well, I couldn't afford it because I was a student. And so I tried to avoid that, and I found lots of different ways, and one of the ways was into library loans. So I was part of University of Essex when I was doing my PhD, and they have a system where you can ask for an interlibrary loan. And it isn't just a book being sent from a different library. They can do interlibrary loans with articles. And that was a really good way. But of course, I had access to that because I was a student of the university. But if you're an independent researcher, you can't do that. And so all of those doors are closed to you. So when I approached Routledge and I sent in my book proposal and they wonderfully said yes, they then asked me the question, would you like to publish open access? And I was a bit stumped to start with because I thought, well, yes, definitely, I would love to, but why are you asking me? Why aren't you just doing it? That was my first probable, it was a question that came to me probably in my ignorance, actually, but I thought they would make the decision. So that was the first thing that I found quite surprising. And then when they asked me and I said, well, yes, but I don't really know what it actually means for me as an author. And I don't really know what it means for other people trying to access it. I would love it to be freely available. And so I had some lovely people at my own university who were able to sort of talk me through some of it. Routledge just said, well, there's a fee to pay. And it's a lot of money. It's £10,000to pay for a book to be open access. And I thought, well, I haven't got £10,000. And I said that to them. And they said, you can ask your institution. So I did.
You mentioned a moment ago, Alison, that you felt that it was kind of unjust in a sense, that kind of process of, you know, putting things behind a paywall or price tag, or and your own experience as a research student. And did you find that was a particular challenge in, say, your discipline, so within a sort of art historical context? Because not all of the people listening to this will probably, you know, will be coming from it from an art historical point of view. But how does that sort of manifest in a disciplinary sense in terms of accessibility?
Yes, I think you're right, and I think because that is my sort of my surrounding ambience, as it were, art history is where I am and where I look for things and where I found barriers. However, I also have a friend who's doing her PhD on vultures in South Africa.
Exciting.
And very exciting. Yeah. It's completely new stuff. She comes up against the same thing.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah,
so
yeah.
She's in a completely different discipline,
yeah,
but still really struggling to find good quality, up-to-date, accurate research that she can access freely. So I don't think it's just one discipline or two disciplines. I think it's probably across the board for people. With art history, we have our problems with images. And I think that is a whole kettle of fish that is probably just for art historians or people in a visual discipline.
Yes, yeah.
That is a really big problem.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that's a, you know, another point we could start on is this challenge around images and what, I mean, broadly speaking, what's called third party copyright within a publication.
I had a lovely email back from the editor saying, we really would love to publish your book. It's a great fit. But we don't think we can publish 500 images. In fact, 70 is our limit. And I just thought, of course, because of that would increase the cost of publishing and it would be crazy. And so I was disappointed to start with, but I said, no, that's fine. I can reduce it. So my first thing that I had to do was to reduce my 500 images to 70. Not easy, but I was able to incorporate into the text links to where people might find the image themselves online. And also I wrote exactly where they came from so that somebody could follow it up themselves without having the image in front of them. So what I did methodically was they said you've got to get image permissions. So I decided, having decided which images I was going to use, I roughly had 20 per chapter. And I have in my study magnetic whiteboards all the way around the room. I put all the images up on the board and then I would send a letter or an email to the copyright holder, and I would have a system of red, amber, green, and then I would be able to say where I was exactly at the moment with that image. Now, this process took a year and a half to get image permissions. And it was a massive, and it was probably the most challenging thing about the book, because I've got my whiteboard, I've got my color system. It meant I could tell at a glance where I was. But I would write to the owner of the image, normally in an institution like the British Museum or the National Gallery, and I would send my own pro forma that I'd written with my request. Routledge had also created an Excel spreadsheet for their records, but I filled this in as I went along, and it included information about the owner of the copyright. I would then say, have I written to them or not, when I wrote to them, if they'd replied, whether they required a fee, and then if I had permission to use the image. But the pitfalls were most institutions would not use my pro forma. So because I'd ask them to sign it to give me permission, and they don't do it like that.
I asked Alison about the particular Creative Commons license she has used for her book, which is CC BY-NC-ND.
Yeah, they gave me a choice actually, and there's about six different types of license. And I must admit, I didn't know the differences to start with. So I spoke to a lovely colleague at work called Sean, and he went through all the different licenses with me. And he is in the open access team here at Essex. He went through all the different licenses with me, and I chose this license. And the reason I chose this license is because I want people to freely read it. Absolutely. I want them to be able to use it. I want them to be able to cite it. But what I don't want them to do is to change it. And some licenses enable people to tweak it. And I just thought that's a really odd thing for me personally, that someone else could take your work and then change it and make it into something else. And I didn't want that to happen. So I wanted this kind of license where this is my work. Please read it. Please use it for free. But please don't change it, because it's my work and that's how I want it to stay.
Yeah.
So that's why I went for this particular license.
Like Alison, Dr. Sean Seeger, a senior lecturer and head of Department of Literature, Film and Theatre Studies, also published his latest book through the Open Access Fund. He describes the nature of the work, his previous experience of open access journals, and now with long-form publications.
The book is the product of work that goes back really over the last 10 or so years, during which time I've been thinking a lot about utopias and dystopias in literature primarily, but also in film, popular culture, and to some extent in social theory and kind of related areas. I suppose the broad kind of focus of my research during that time has been on people who are interested in imagining alternative kinds of society. So people who have tried to imagine societies or worlds that are in some way an improvement on the world that we live in. And also, on the other hand, people who have had dystopian or darker or more apocalyptic visions of things, and everything in between. And the book is quite wide ranging, as the title suggests. So although it's grounded in literary studies, which is where my primary background is, it also engages with various kinds of popular culture and what I'm calling utopian discourse more generally, which I find in all kinds of places, including in the realm of self-help, social and political theory, contemporary cinema, blog posts, and all kinds of other materials. So it's utopia and utopianism in literature and in lots of other areas as well.
So how did you come to work with your own university to make that work open access? What was the process for you?
I'd had some previous experience with publishing via open access. If memory serves, I'd published two journal articles in open access format. So I did have some familiarity with it. And I had a very positive experience of that. So the opportunity to publish those articles via open access actually came from the journals in question. I think they were promoting open access at the time, and they'd received funding from elsewhere. And I certainly noticed that those open access articles had been quite widely read, and they'd been downloaded and they'd been read by graduate students, and they were mentioned to me at a number of conferences and other kind of events I attended. So I had the perception that open access material is being more widely read than work that's behind various kinds of paywalls. And then the library at Essex had promoted open access, I think, at a number of events I'd attended. So it was on my radar. And as I neared the end of completing work on the monograph, I decided to approach the library and cultural services team about this. They had experience of working with the publisher, Peter Lang, that I was publishing with. And they immediately got in touch with them. So I was delighted by that response, and it was all a lot more straightforward than I'd expected.
Was Peter Lang sort of a publisher that you had on your radar already, that you'd sort of maybe published works of a similar area or kind of field?
Yes, they were very much on my radar. With my first book, which was adapted from my PhD thesis, I had a number of publishers in mind, and I approached various publishers over the course of a year or so, and I settled on Routledge in the end, who had a series where I think it fitted very well. But in the case of this book, Utopian Variations, I'd always intended to publish with Peter Lang, because they have a book series in Utopian Studies, which is published in association with a research centre based in Ireland called the Rallaghine Utopian Studies Centre. And they have published the majority of the major texts in the subfield of Utopian Studies. And they had, a particular series where I felt that my current research really suited very kind of directly. So I'd always had Peter Lang's Utopian Studies series in mind. When I approached them about the Open Access Fund, again, they were very receptive to that. It's something they've done before. And on the Rallaghine website, they have a kind of very handy way of filtering and searching for open access texts. It's kind of it has an unlock sort of symbol next to it to show which ones are open access. So I knew that they'd done this before, and I'd downloaded some of their open access publications and used those in my own research as well. And I knew that was the destination for this publication all along.
Were there any particular challenges when it came to, say, licensing third-party content from film and literature? You know, maybe smaller kind of quotations and things, and maybe not so much of an issue for most scholars, but I suppose extended pieces or photographs or other kinds of works that you might need permission from. How does that work with an open access publication?
Yeah, that's a good question. So in my first book, a lesson that I had learnt when it came to copyrighted material was that there is a very significant difference between quoting poetry and quoting from prose texts. And unfortunately, in my first publication, I had to cite poetry quite a lot. And that meant going in search of permissions from a number of publishers, which substantially delayed the publication process. I think I was well over a year getting permissions for some copyrighted material. And only toward the end of that process discovered I had to get the same permissions in a United States context as well. So there were additional permissions, and it was very protracted. But quoting from prose sources, of course, is very different, and you're able to quote a much more substantial extract before you have to go and search for permissions. So in the case of this text, in the case of Utopian Variations, I didn't have to seek out permission for copyrighted material, because all of the extracts were comparatively short. And in the case of the visual texts, what I've tended to go in for, and this has to do with my style of analysis, is detailed descriptions of particular visuals followed by my analysis rather than reproducing images. That just has to do with my kind of method and my preferred approach, because I think that there's actually a lot of critical significance in the act of description itself. And I think there's a lot of value to that. So in the case of this project, I didn't need to get permission for still images or for reproducing, you know, pictures of advertisements or anything of that sort. If it had been a different sort of project, yes, I would have reproduced posters and other things and discussed those. But as it happened on this occasion, I've gone for detailed descriptions instead. I'm quite interested in, again, cultural discourses. So discourses that cross different media and mediums and historical periods and so on. And they're not necessarily confined to just one genre or form or medium. It could kind of cross all sorts of different cultural forms. And that's partly why the project had to be somewhat broader than just literary studies, because these are things that are out there across society and culture, and they show up in all kinds of places.
Yeah. And a very great rationale for open access, I guess, that, you know, you're not closing this off or putting it behind a paywall that is only going to be focused on perhaps by a smaller group of scholars, but actually potentially making that widely freely available to any number of scholars across different disciplines to draw on.
I think that's a real benefit in the case of this project. Open access seems like a particularly suitable route, given that, again, if memory serves, there are 8 chapters to the book, and those chapters cover a very wide range of subjects. And I'd like to think they would be of interest to people across the arts, the humanities, and to some extent the social sciences as well. So if this book is out there online and it's visible and it's accessible to anyone in principle with an internet connection, hopefully there'll be something there, even if it's just a chapter or a section or a subsection of the book, which will be of interest to a quite broad audience. So yeah, in terms of open access, I think that's very beneficial.
As we've heard from these interviews, open access publishing has tremendous benefits for researchers. As we discovered in episode 1, there's a greater potential for scholarly work to be more widely consulted and cited by students and academic staff alike. There are also clear advantages for reaching groups such as non-governmental organisations and in crossing disciplinary boundaries. Sean Seeger's point about interdisciplinarity might resonate with some of our listeners. There are some points to consider, however. Alison's reflections on third-party copyright would apply for any traditional book that reproduced images, but it's important to note the terms under which the publication will be released, in this case under a Creative Commons licence. This needs to be made clear to each individual or organisation that's granting permission to reproduce their material. Having a system for tracking this information, I think, can be easily translated to the electronic publication of a thesis for a research degree or a journal article. As Sean Anderson and Sean Seeger's contributions show, it's crucial to secure advice from your university about available funds for open access and the kinds of publishers to approach. This ensures that the content of the work aligns well with existing titles and fields of scholarship. A final point, which I'll end on, is Sean Anderson's comments about promotion. Making a work open access removes many barriers to potential readers or users of research outputs, but researchers need to employ a large range of features and tools in the open research ecosystem to really make their work known to others. Word of mouth, digital object identifiers or DOIs, sharing information and links to the work through social media platforms, blog posts, and even short-form videos of authors discussing their work can help to raise awareness of what has been produced and its value for different communities within and beyond academia. That's it for our second episode. Next time on PGR Matters, we'll return to the issue of developing engagement with open research by talking to Dr. Samuel Moore, the lead researcher on the MORPHS project. We take a deep dive into the world of gamification and discussion with Hannah Crago from the University of Essex, whose recent experience of research-focused learning activities lays the foundations for an upcoming training program for postgraduate researchers.